Good day, listeners. This is your host, Michael Martins, with the Martins Critical Review, broadcasting this morning from a nearly bluebird day here in south-central British Columbia. In today's program, we take a philosophical look at one of the most important and fundamental tenets of a modern-day functional society, namely freedom and its multiple implications. Joining us again today for this program is Dr. Francis Christian, MD. And this brings me to a subject which has recently been cooked up in my brain, and I've shared it with a number of my friends and supporters regarding the evolution of the new human paradigm. And essentially, in the dark days which are ahead, when the compliant vaccinated peoples become ill and begin to suffer and die, and the propaganda engines continue to grind out the information on vilifying the dirty unvaccinated horde, it will be the love and humanity within those oppressed underclass that will express unconditional love, kindness, and compassion towards their fellow humans and assist them through their darkness. And this is going to mark an evolutionary and spiritual shift between the old world and the new world, which is essentially, I think, what you're saying through that process of love and freedom and the altruism of the human spirit.
I agree. One of the things that has fascinated me is the interplay between love and hate in this COVID era. So if you look at the vaccinated, there's been a lot of vitriol and hate thrown against the unvaccinated, okay, or the uninjected. I would ask any historian or social scientist to look at how much hate there's been on the opposite side. I would say yes, very little or nothing. So, in other words, those who are uninjected or unvaccinated are looking at their vaccinated brothers and sisters with love rather than hate. And we see a very interesting human experiment there. The hate is almost all on the vaccinated side. Like the Prime Minister saying, what do we do with these people? You know, how do we tolerate them? Which is basically right out of the fascist playbook, fascist terminology. And right down to, medical officers of health and so on. And last year our premier famously said he's losing patience with the unvaccinated, so this hate of the unvaccinated by the vaccinated is countered by the love and the concern of the vaccinated uninjected for the injected or the vaccinated. So I would say love always wins in the end. It's one of the laws of nature. Yes. It's one of the sum total of reality supports love, not hate.
Yes, yes. And you shared a scripture from St. John in one of your essays there, which was that the light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has never mastered it. What is your interpretation of this passage?
Right. So it's from the first chapter of the Gospel according to St. John. And it's talking about the arrival of the Word made flesh, Jesus, in the world to save mankind. The world is a very hostile place for love. It's a very hostile place for truth. Is a very hostile place for selfless and forgiving love. So it was and it is a hostile place for the love of God in Jesus. But Jesus, as I was telling you, took that love to the cross, and far from it being a defeat, the Romans and the leaders of the religious groups at the time thought of him also as a terrorist or a troublemaker or an insurgent, and they thought that crucifying him will be the end. But the resurrection showed that there's no limit to the love of God, and the love of God always triumphs, and the light shines on in the darkness, and the darkness has never mastered it.
Yes, yes, a very powerful statement. So let's examine the concept of the common good, a phrase and ideology which has been rather weaponized over the last few years and has certainly been used in the past as well.
This term, the common good, is in fact the refuge of every tyrant. They appeal to this thing called the common good, and even democracies have done that. So many people think of fascism as the Nazi fascist regime or Mussolini. But the fact is, both Mussolini and Hitler got elected through a democratic process. In other words, there is this this idea that democracy by itself can bring us freedom. But in fact, the evidence shows that democracy can actually lead to tyranny. And maybe that's already happening in many countries, including Canada now. So democracies that have morphed into fascist tyrannies have invoked this idea of the common good. And the common good, for example, in Hitler's time, was to kill the Jews, the Slavs, the Poles, the Gypsies, the homosexual people, what the Nazi regime defined as the Untermensch. And the Untermensch, the killing of the Untermensch was supposed to be the common good. So in the Soviet Union, the common good was supposed to be served by, putting millions of people in the gulag. The Soviet authorities engineered famines for the common good, because they wanted to collectivize farming. And so this idea of the common good has been, it's a favorite tool of tyrants. So people shouldn't be fooled by this idea of the common good. One should always, first of all, if you look at the term, it should actually make sense. Is it good, for example, in the COVID era, not to question the official narrative? Is it good not to follow the science? Is it good to recommend an unsafe, ineffective vaccine for our children? It's not good, obviously. It doesn't serve any good. So it's not the common good in any case. So this idea of the common good is a favorite tool of tyrants, and people should be wary, because tyrants often will say, oh, this is for everybody's, like they say, oh, we want to keep everybody safe by abusing the kids with masks, social distancing, vaccines. That's not the common good at all.
Yeah, I guess unless you, depending how you define the common good, of course, right?
Yes.
So, Dr. Christian, why do tyrants vehemently fear truth?
Well, because the truth exposes the tyranny. Now, free speech speaks truth to power. Now, not everything that is said under the right of free speech is true, but what the tyrant fears is the clash of true ideas with false ideas. Because that in that clash of truth with falsehood, of what is beautiful, what is ugly, that clash of good ideas with bad ideas, in the light and sparks of that clash, the tyrant stands naked and exposed. So that's why the tyrant fears truth, wants to suppress it, wants to suppress free speech, wants to suppress dissent, wants to suppress anybody who questions the data, the questions the narrative. Absolutely. The tyrant fears truth.
And that is then why the concept of freedom of speech and being able to speak truth to power is so vitally important for a healthy and functioning society.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's linked to truth.
Yes. So in this woke era where one's feelings seem to warrant trampling another's rights, how do you suggest we embrace freedom of speech and allow it to flourish?
Yeah, so this is a matter of survival of our societies, okay? Because if you enforce only one view, the fact is that society will die. Human beings are richly endowed with the ability to have several views and to follow life in several different paths. And if you quash that and squash it and make human beings follow only one path, that is a sure recipe for the decimation of the race. And so wokeness is a matter of survival. I in my Substack essay on free speech, I talk about wokeness and its association with hate laws or hate speech laws. So this is a relatively new development in our, our Western Christian civilization democracies. And hate speech laws are supposed to protect the individual from, feeling distress, emotional distress, mental distress, and so on. Of course, it completely excludes physical violence, which has to be completely stopped, completely proscribed, completely forbidden by societies. But this ability to feel hurt, to feel distressed, is essential for human growth. The teenager. When the parent corrects the teenager or speaks something to the teenager doesn't like, they typically feel hurt. They feel distressed. They feel all kinds of negative things, which are actually driving them to a positive outcome. So, and then between husband and wife, how often do husband and wife feel distressed and hurt with what the spouse is saying? But are we saying we should ban that kind of speech completely? No, because that is the price of human progress and price of growth. And so we can't ban hate speech. The other problem with banning it is who defines hate? What is hate? Who gets to define what is hate? Now, for example, I give the example in my essay of Justin Trudeau and his numerous blackface photographs. So blackface is this racist, terrible, derogatory costume and painting a white person painting his or her face black. And Justin Trudeau has been seen with a blackface in many photographs. Now, if the government of Canada under Justin Trudeau decides that using the word blackface is hate speech, that makes a mockery of all hate speech laws. But that can happen. In fact, I give the example of a recent example in England where the Hampshire police actually arrested and put a person in chains, handcuffed a person and arrested and took the person away for merely tweeting what somebody else had put on Facebook. Okay? So who gets to define hate? So that's another problem. Yes, and the biggest problem perhaps is that if you have these hate speech laws and people don't speak what they want to say, that will go underground. That will not be challenged. So if you want to challenge hate speech, what you define as hate speech, challenge it with other speech, better speech. And then people will get to see this clash of ideas. And that is risky because either side can be defeated in what they believe. But that is essential for human progress. Yes. So this wokeism, where certain terms are protected and cannot be questioned, is very bad for society. It's suicidal.
Well, and of course, then there becomes a very fine line between censorship, which is invoked to support a narrative by calling it hate speech. I mean, it's a very precipitous slope in terms of, where do those limits on definitions come from? And that also brings up another subject where we've entered an era of frequently changing definitions. Obviously, there's tremendous risk associated with this. Do you know of any historical examples of this, definition changing?
Yes, because when you change languages, is the way human beings communicate, and if you change essential language, then you change the parameters, the basic currency of life, which is language. And if you change the definition of, say, what it means to be female or what it means to be male, and say that, anybody who thinks he is female can be female, anybody who thinks she is male can be male, then that is an assault on language and what language has taught us. Now, yes, in the past, language has been used in order to suppress people and to control people and so on. In the Soviet Union, for example, there were certain categories of people who were, for example, the word bourgeois. The bourgeois term was abused. Not just in the Soviet Union, it was also abused in revolutionary France. So, if you're a bourgeois, it meant that you opposed the kind of tyrannical, extremely woke ideology of communism, and instead you allied yourself with things like private property, personal responsibility, and so on. So, and that was abused because the word bourgeois became a bad word. It became what was associated with personal responsibility was called bourgeois. What is associated with the ability to control your own property, your own decision, was bourgeois. So that was an example of a word that was used to put forward a tyrannical narrative. In the modern era, though, the use of words is predicated on the postmodern philosopher's idea of reality. So if you look at the work of Jacques Derrida and Michel Foucault and so on, that teaching of postmodernism and this your own reality is the only reality, there is no objective reality, infiltrated our universities back in the 50s and 60s. So we are actually we sowed to the winds and we are reaping the whirlwinds. The COVID tyranny didn't happen in a vacuum.
No.
Our universities were taken over in the 60s, 70s, 80s by this kind of woke ideologies, because the disciples of that, of Derrida and Foucault and so on, became our teachers. It became the teachers of teachers in our training institutes. So our teachers who go through teaching school and university are also trained by these woke ideologies. And so this is the changing of names, the changing of definitions, the changing of what is she and what is he. This is very dangerous for society.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So, Dr. Christian, let's now dive into democracy and explore this concept. You have suggested that one could define democracy as government of the deceived, by the deceiver, and for the deceiver. Could you explain this statement to us, please.
Well, that definition that I wrote of democracy is the opposite of what President Lincoln, the great President Lincoln, defined as a government of the people, by the people, for the people. In fact, the history of democracy has shown that it is often, more often, unfortunately, the government of the deceiver, and by the deceiver and of the deceived and for the deceived. And the reason for that is democracy has many fundamental and terrible flaws. And in my essay in my Substack, francischristian.substack.com, I go into some of the problems with democracies. Now, for example, everybody says one member, one person, one vote, or you know, everybody has a vote. And if you don't like a government, you can throw the government out. But here are some problems with that very fundamental idea. Many people in democracies don't vote, and we say to them, oh, you know, if you don't vote, you can't change things. But the reason they don't really vote is because they feel they have no choice. So whether you call the government conservative, or you call it liberal, or you call it, you know, labor, or you call it whatever else you want to call it, they're all beholden to the corporations. And politicians are seen by many of our population as being salesmen and saleswomen for the big corporations. So the global corporations control governments. So that's how people see it. And they say, what's the point of me voting? Because no matter who I vote for, the same policies are what I get. So that is one basic flaw with, you know, with this idea that you can change your government. Yes, you may be able to change it, but you are likely to be stuck with the same policies unless you're vigilant. And then you look at, the ability of democracies to have what is supposed to be fundamental in a democracy, which is an independent judiciary. In other words, the judges are independent, an independent executive, such as the police or the Secret Service, these are executive branches of government, and an independent legislature, which makes the laws, parliamentarians and so on. These three branches of government are supposed to be independent of each other. And any observer in any of our modern democracies can tell you that they're not independent of each other. They influence each other. They are corrupted by each other. And in my essay, I give examples of how the judiciary is not independent in most cases of the people who appoint the judges. So I am not saying that every judge is corrupt. And thank God for upright and extremely moral judges. We do have them, and we have to give thanks to God for these wonderful judges. But the fact is, many judges are not necessarily independent. In our democracies, judges are appointed by governments, and that applies to every democracy that you can think of, including the United States. Now, your listeners would know what a partisan thing it is to get a Supreme Court judge appointed in the U.S. So this idea that the judiciary is independent of the legislature is actually a myth, a fallacy. And then you look at the legislature, which is the people who make our laws, the people we elect. These guys can be bribed. And the bribing occurs in different ways. There was a study not so many years ago, how in the U.S. Congress, most congressmen and women enter the Congress, the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, as middle-class or lower-middle-class people, and they leave as millionaires. How does that happen? They also get, as soon as they leave politics, they get into, you know, the boards of banks, you know, or they advise foreign governments, like, you know, Stephen Harper is now, I think, doing a consultancy of, you know, I think because of his knowledge of government, he can then tell the companies and the globalists and so on how to get around the rules of government. So, and then you have this thing called the official lobbyist. You can actually apply in Canada, in the US, to be an official briber. That's what I call them. Because you can give money in various ways to influence your ideas. And you can be certified as an official lobbyist. In many countries, US included, in my essay, I give a link to foreign lobbying governments that in the US. So foreign governments can also become official bribing agencies. So legislature is not independent. Look at the executive. The executive is supposed to be independent, but look at what Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, did to our executive. He brought in an emergency even without the approval of Parliament, and then unleashed the brutality of a very brutal police crackdown, that is the executive, on the people. So the executive, the police, the FBI are politicized. They're not independent of the other branches of government. If you look at the CIA, for example, they've engineered coups, massacres, revolutions all over the world, including in our backyard in Latin America. And if you look at the MK Ultra, if your listeners are interested, the CIA and say CSIS is supposed to do things to foreign governments and so on for American interest. What has been shown is, in fact, the coups that they engineer is actually against American interests. I don't know who they benefit. They probably only benefit the arms manufacturers and so on. But in addition to that, they also work against their own people. So if your listeners just Google MK Ultra, it was a program that the CIA conducted in Canada and the United States against our own people. People were picked up from the street, given drugs against their will, against consent, to see the effect of LSD and other things on their brains. Some people died because of MK Ultra and so on. So the executive branch of government it doesn't work for the people either. It's supposed to. In many cases, it does, but it doesn't have to. So there is room for corruption there too. So democracy is not this great ideal that mankind should strive for, but freedom. In other words, every democratic institution, every judge, every politician, every policeman should be measured against this yardstick of freedom. And if they don't measure up, we must resist. We must resist with everything we have. Because if we don't defend freedom, we will not have anything resembling normal life left.
And are you aware of the recent scandal within the Conservative Party of Canada with respect to the leadership candidates Grant Abram and Joseph Burgo? And what does this say about the Canadian system?
Well, that's a good example, Michael, of the deficit in our democratic institutions. Actually, Joseph Burgo, I know well. He's a friend of mine. Joseph Burgo is actually a successful industrialist. His company decided to work out of rural Saskatchewan to give jobs to rural kids so that they don't have to leave the province and go to other places. It is said that one out of every six farm tools in Saskatchewan is a Burgo farm tool. So he is a very successful businessman, but somebody who uses the profits and shares the profits with people around him. and who is a great warrior for freedom, and I'm very pleased that I can call him my friend. Joseph Bourgault decided to run for the conservative leadership, and to this day, I don't think anybody really knows why he was disqualified. So there were so many things that were said that, you know, there was something in the way the money was raised, but that again seems to me to be very flimsy arguments. But nobody really is sure, and the Conservative Party headquarters haven't really given us, as far as I know, a proper explanation why he was disqualified. In other words, somebody who was talking about freedom and in things inconvenient for the party is liable to be disqualified for some technical reason. The in a democracy, if you want participation of the people, even if there's a small technical fault, the party should be proactive in telling the party involved, in other words, Joseph Bourgault in this case, hey, this is the thing that's happening. Shouldn't you be correcting this so that we can have you as a leader? In other words, giving the benefit of the doubt to the person who's actually running for leadership for technical reasons, not for moral reasons, or, you know, nobody wants to say that, you know, if you're a convicted murderer, you should still be able to run. No. Bourgault is salt of the earth, wonderful guy, industrialist, giving jobs to people here. He is conservative gold, in my opinion. And he should have been encouraged to run. And if there was a technical issue, I'm sure it could have been corrected in time so that he could run. But the fact is, he was disqualified. Yes. And yeah, did you by any chance get to meet Joseph Bourgault?
No, but I had several colleagues in Alberta that were assisting his fundraising, and they were shocked with the outcome.
Yes, yes.
I also had another colleague that was working with Grant Abram down in the Lower Mainland of British Columbia.
Right,
very similar story, and you know, to me, that clearly represents that in this country, those who wield the levers of power are carefully selected. And, you know, on the outside, both of these gentlemen have a CV which would, you know, show that they're competent in terms of being a leader. Yet they've been removed from the race. And we have, you know, Jean Charest, who's been accepted into that. So, I mean, it's clear to me that, you know, if you're not towing the party line, the one party line, and you're not willing to embrace the woke agenda and the rest of the craziness, that you're simply not welcome at the party. And you know, I guess that's something that we're going to need to have to address as we move through this process. And it's been said many times, and it's, you know, warrants repeating, that both in Canada and America presently, these are probably two of the least qualified administrations that have ever run a country. You know, it's a complete lack of business experience. I mean, they're, you know, our finance minister has a Russian literature degree. You know, the health minister is an economist. I mean, we live in the land of absurdity, and at some point the absurdity will crash against reality and it will break. It has to.
I totally agree. I mean, the disaster that you described, that is the governments of Canada and the USA, will collapse under the weight of their own contradictions.
Yes,
that's what these incompetent governments do. I do think, though, that the global corporations and the globalists, for them, both Biden and Trudeau are probably dispensable, just like Boris Johnson was dispensable. Because they know that no matter which party they get into power, you know, they can control that person, and hopefully it'll be different. You know, every time we hope it'll be different, right? So when a new government gets into power, the people think, oh, it's going to be different, and then some of the same policies are carried out, and many other policies, they're only cosmetic changes, right?
Yes.
So yes. We'll see. For example, in this COVID debacle, this COVID government debacle, the only party and the only party leader that has consistently opposed these soul-sapping, business-destroying lockdowns, these mask mandates, these injections that are not safe and not effective, is the PPC and Maxime Bernier. Okay. Now, if you look at the Conservative Party, virtually all of them, probably with the exception of Leslyn Lewis, they only came on board when the truckers got to Ottawa. Okay. So, in fact, in the last election, it was very comical because I had a PPC sign on my lawn. And people were looking at me because if you're a PPC supporter, you're supposed to be a white supremacist, right? So, I'm looking at people looking really confused because there's this brown white supremacist me coming in and out of this house with a PPC sign. So, you know,
it's very confusing.
The media is very good at sort of labeling. People with certain labels, and then they run with those labels, right?
Yes.
So the PPC is supposed to be white supremacist, although they had the most diverse range of candidates in the last election. So just to give an example, you know, no matter who you vote into power, you're likely to get the same result unless you have a radical change. Now, the radical change, for example, you know, Trump was something of a radical change, but they completely clipped his wings and didn't allow him to do anything. So this is the problem in our democracies, right? So democracy is not an answer to a maiden's prayer. Freedom is. So it's freedom that needs to be defended, sometimes against the abuse of democracy.
Yes, yes. And so that ultimately is the question then for society, is not whether or not to have democracy, that freedom is the tantamount element to any functioning society.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So some concluding thoughts here and concluding questions, Dr. Christian. First off, would you agree now more than ever we need to reject division and separation and come together fully as earthlings and move beyond tribalism, race-based division, or any other forms of separation?
You know, that's a very good question, Michael. I think it's very, very important and a very good statement, too. It's very important to recognize our common humanity. So whatever our background, whatever our race, whatever our experience of the vaccine or lockdown or whatever else it is, we're all God's children. We all inherit the ability of choosing between good and evil, free will. We all are vulnerable human beings in a vulnerable environment. We need to support each other, come together, like you said. I don't have any hatred at all of the vaccinated or the injected. I would appeal to the injected, the vaccinated, not to have any hatred or animosity against the unvaccinated. Even though the science now is showing that nobody needed to get vaccinated if you were young and healthy, for example, and so on. So I would say, yes, we have to come together. Now, coming together, though, doesn't mean accepting the tyranny. Coming together means coming together as human beings, recognizing our common humanity. But it doesn't mean recognizing and accepting evil and tyranny. For that, I think humanity is equipped with the tools to fight and ultimately to defeat tyranny.
Yes, yes. So what must happen or be put in place for this shameful episode in our history never to be repeated?
Well, I think, you know, the great leaders of the past have shown us the pathway. I would come back to how one of the greatest empires the world has ever seen, the British Empire, was brought to its knees by a little man in a loincloth using soul force against brute force. And the elements of civil disobedience, it's already being done and has been done in Canada, which is massive involvement of people in a repeated fashion. The truckers showed us that. It means in a non-violent, peaceful way, resisting the tyranny, embarrassing the tyranny, inconveniencing the tyranny. The truckers embarrassed the government, not only in Canada, but all over the world. And thirdly, the willingness to sacrifice. So the fact that this completely non-violent, completely legal, completely peaceful protester, Tamara Lish, grandmother, wonderful musician, and somebody who had no criminal history at all, was jailed by Trudeau, shows that all three elements were working very well for the civil disobedience movement. Massive participation, embarrassing and inconveniencing the tyranny, and the willingness to suffer. So a Gandhian movement was born with the truckers convoy, freedom convoy. And I can see that there is only one way that the movements for freedom can end, and that is in victory. That's been shown again and again and again by history. The tyrants have always been defeated. And I repeat, tyranny has a defined lifespan, and no tyranny lasts forever.
Oh, that's fantastic, sir. Do you have an inspirational passage or a message you'd like to share with the audience today to assist them making this transformational shift forward?
Well, I would again repeat the fact that no tyranny lasts forever, and every tyranny has a defined lifespan. And what I would say to the people is what the great scientist and humanitarian Peter McCullough told me, which is be relentless and remember God has chosen you for this. So if you think that you're being oppressed, there's a reason why God has put you there to fight the oppression. If you think you're being unfairly targeted by mandates, there's a reason God has put you there to fight those mandates. And if you think that you're being silenced, there's a reason that God has put you there so that you can speak up for those who cannot speak up. For example, the children who have no voice of their own. We must be their voice. We must protect them from this injection, which is very bad for their health, and which is being pushed by our governments. And the second thing is be relentless. Never let up, because every tyranny is destined to fall.
Very inspirational, sir. Thank you. And what's on the horizon for Dr. Christian, and how can listeners learn more about you and your work?
You know, Michael, I'm very busy with a whole lot of things. I'm a poet, and my book of poems was published and released to the world by HARP, H-A-R-P, HARP Press, last year. The book of poems is called To a Nurse Friend Weeping. And so if you Google To a Nurse Friend Weeping, it'll take you to the HARP Press website, and you can then order the book from there. I'm also doing the Substack. And once again, the Substack is called francischristian.substack.com. And there you can find my essays, and I plan later on to read some of my poems and do a little podcast within the Substack too. So that is what I'm busy with. I'm busy with a whole lot of other things in Saskatchewan. There's a new party that has been started. It's called the Saskatchewan United Party, and I've been advising that party too. So there are a whole lot of things that I'm busy with, and I cannot thank you enough for the privilege of being on your show.
Well, thank you so much, sir. It's been an honor to share some space with a scholar and a poet. I wish you all the best in your endeavors, and I'll be putting a couple links there in the show notes that people can refer to view your Substack, which again is very well written and informative and thought provoking, and we'll get a link up on your book as well. So that's all for today. I thank you as always for your time, and God bless, and may the world be filled with love and happiness for you, sir.
Absolutely. And for you too, Michael, God bless you too. And thanks again for having me on your show.
Okay, we'll do it again.
Thanks, absolutely. Sir.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye.